Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Something from Martha Rose Shulman. Now, she's a guest you're going to hear from in a few minutes. It had never occurred to me that herbs are like kale. I mean, they're dark, healthy greens, but they're so much easier to sell to the taste shy. Think about basil pesto. Well, then take the pesto idea a step further. Pestos are done with other green herbs, like coriander. And it's surprising where coriander can take you. Like Georgia, you know, part of the former Soviet Union. Well, they make a sauce there of fresh coriander, dried apricots, walnuts, and spices. I have to tell you, seduction is an understatement. Well, we're going to be diving into that idea and much more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and is supported by the Oregon Bounty Wander Feast, featuring a new flavor each week. This week, Oregon goes nuts. Learn what you can do with Oregon hazelnuts, walnuts, wild chestnuts, and more at traveloregon.com. And by Cabot Creamery, a 1,200-farm family dairy cooperative valuing community, quality, democracy, and local ownership. Producing naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese with recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. You know, the call-in part of the show is a favorite of mine. A lot of my life's been spent in cooking class kitchens talking through the things that puzzle all of us about food. I get a kick out of it. Which is why this week, instead of waiting until the usual time we take calls, I want to take one right off the bat. We've got Bill, and he's from Seattle. Bill's on the line. Hey, Bill, how are you? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good.
Oh, great. Well, I've been researching a book I'm writing on heirloom vegetables, and I started growing different types of garlic. And it's really been great fun to try the different varieties in various dishes in the kitchen.
Right, right.
And I've been trying to figure out the best use for each variety and only having some success at it. And that's where I could use your help.
Well, tell me, how many varieties are you growing?
Well, this year I grew five varieties.
Okay. And what are their flavor characteristics?
Well, you know, some of them, my favorite is Spanish Roja, and that is just a wonderful sort of a medium-strong variety that I found to be really great in stir-fries, like with Asian vegetables and fresh ginger.
Right, right.
And, you know, if you just use, if I make a stir-fry today with Spanish Roja, and then I make a stir-fry tomorrow with Chesnock Red, I'm not really being able to test them side by side. So, you know, what kind of a kitchen test could I do that would showcase the flavors of garlic so I could
do the same thing you do with anything else. You pick the simplest recipe. First of all, you taste them raw.
Uh-huh.
And you do some unsalted saltines and plain water in between to cleanse your palate, because you're talking pretty strong.
Yes.
You know. Mm-hmm. Then what I would do, now this is, we're talking here heavy-duty testing, but this is the fun of doing a food book, I think. Then I would take each one and I would lightly sauté it. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Because that knocks out certain volatile aspects of the garlic, and it's going to give you another dimension. But do it in the same pan, okay?
Uh-huh.
Same
right.
amount of oil, same level of heat.
Mm-hmm.
One after another, put them each on separate pieces of cloth or, you know, a plate, and let them cool down and taste them then and see if you really taste differences. Then the next thing I would do is I would do the simplest stir fry you can imagine. pick a basic dish. For instance, if we were testing baking chocolates, we would choose the simplest brownie recipe we could think of. So pick a simple dish where that garlic is important. Do the exact same dish with the five different garlics and taste it. And you may find that you say to yourself, you know what, you could use almost any garlic in any of these dishes, you know, in this dish, and it's going to taste good. But this is the characteristic of this garlic when it's raw. This is the characteristic of it when it's cooked. That means, you know, if it's very delicate, it's going to be wonderful with gentle greens, you know, like the chards and the whatever. You see where I'm going?
Yes.
Because you've got basic flavor profiles or characteristics. You've got the big, robust flavors. You've got the flavors with a lot of chili heat. You want a garlic that stands up and salutes. When you have a garlic that's sort of quiet, sits in a corner, you might call it a tad wimpy. You know, that's what you want with the very subtle things like the chicken with tarragon and a tad of cream. You see where I'm going? So that's how I would test it. It's terribly scientific.
Oh, yes. Well, and then you have the most wonderful pesto out of it or
well, yeah. I mean, when you get all done, by the way, you put it all together and you just feast. Exactly.
Yeah. That's what I'm looking for. And I just I want to be able to – I've got these heirloom garlics and to show them off to my friends and my readers. Here's some garlic. Grow this for your pesto next spring.
What's the book going to be called?
It's called Edible Heirlooms. Heritage Vegetables for the Maritime Garden.
That's
and it's
fabulous.
Focused on growing vegetables in a short season maritime climate. So basically from San Francisco to Vancouver, BC, on sort of the rainy side of the mountain.
Right. And also that could apply to the Northeast as well.
And yes, definitely even up into Maine in the coastal climates there that are really temperate.
Well, Bill, we'll look forward to seeing the book. Great, good luck with it, and enjoy the garlic.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, you take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's how you test garlic. In fact, that's probably how you test almost anything. You know, it is interesting, though, to think about the nuance of a single ingredient. Recently, I came across a piece by Martha Rose Shulman. She does the Recipes for Health column for the New York Times. Well, I've got Martha in the studio. Martha, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You did a piece on coriander sauces with fresh coriander.
Yes.
And I'd like to talk about that because I don't think people know what to do with coriander.
You know, everybody thinks of coriander, cilantro, Mexican food. That's what comes into their mind.
Right, exactly.
But in the eastern and southern Mediterranean, they love fresh coriander. I mean, to the extent that they make incredible sauces with it. The way we think of Italians and basil and pesto, there's a sauce called cermoula, which comes from Morocco, that is used as a marinade and a sauce for fish usually, although I use it for just about everything. Very heavy on the coriander. I say heavy, but it doesn't taste heavy. It tastes incredibly light and refreshing.
How do you go about making it?
Well, that is a straight puree. They would use a mortar and pestle. It's got a lot of garlic. It's got spices, cumin and cinnamon. Sometimes it can be spicy with a little bit of cayenne. Sometimes it's got saffron. And also, they use a mix of coriander and parsley, but it's the coriander that really stands out.
And if I remember, isn't there lemon and olive oil as well?
Yes, and always olive oil, of course. We're in the Mediterranean, and lemon juice. Yeah.
And then you dip into that?
They don't really use it in a dipping kind of way. They would marinate fish, and then they would use it as a sauce for the fish, too. Now, what I do with it is I will take something that can be kind of dull on its own, or people think it is, but something like cauliflower. Mm-hmm. And I'll blanch the cauliflower, and then I'll toss it with a little olive oil and put it in the oven and roast it so it gets nice and crispy brown. And then I'll serve that with the cermoula. And in Morocco as well, they serve carrots with it. I like it with roasted winter squash, as we're getting into squash season. It can just kind of take any plain food and make it incredibly interesting.
I must say, you've really got me hungry. I'm thinking of the cauliflower and the squash. All right, but is coriander used in other places? We know Mexico, China, you'll sometimes call Chinese parsley. Where else?
Well, it's, I think, probably the favorite herb in the Republic of Georgia. And they have a signature sauce, which is just called Georgian cilantro sauce in English. It is the most beguiling thing. You take, well, what I do, there they use apricot leather because they make apricot leather all the time. I take dried apricots and soak them in warm water until they're nice and soft. And then you blend the apricots with, again, lots of garlic, walnuts, and lots of cilantro, coriander. But you also add some other incredibly pungent herbs like tarragon and dill. And parsley as well.
Wow.
To this. It is amazing. It's you can eat it with a spoon. It's so good. Because not only does it have that great, those great flavors of the herbs and the sweetness and the kind of rich depth from the apricots, but it has the texture because of the walnuts. So people kind of go, what is this? And in Georgia, they'll stir it. They make red beans, lubio, and they stir the coriander sauce into the beans. It's just wonderful.
Oh, that's and is it served warm then?
The sauce isn't served warm, but it's served. It's stirred into warm dishes. Uh-huh. Although the beans are usually served room temperature, kind of more like a salad.
I'm thinking of what how delicious this would be on any vegetable.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of anything it would not be good on.
On a crostini. I mean, yeah, I was testing these all of these recipes a few weeks ago, and I just kept taking a spoon and eating, and I would take it to dinner parties. They would go, what is this?
Can you imagine that? You know that deep, dark rye that's moist, you know, it's so dense.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be fabulous on that
bread? And on walnut bread because you've got the walnut complements.
Yeah, this is definitely a keeper. Hey, thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Martha Rose Shulman is the author of 25 cookbooks, including Mediterranean Harvest. Now, her latest project is a cooking school in Venice, California. Martha wrote about those coriander sauces in her New York Times column, Recipes for Health. Now, you can find her recipes for that Georgian cilantro sauce and shermoula on our website, splendidtable.org. You know, believe it or not, there may actually be a good thing to come out of this economy. A flock of restaurants are aiming for good food at reasonable prices. Now, we found two dynamite ones in the Denver area. The first is called Snooze, and it's all about breakfast. And the setting, well, I guess the best way to describe the setting is it's pure Jetsons Revisited. Mid-century, gone berserk, and I hope you like a lot of orange and a lot of aqua. Local farmers rule at Snooze, but it was the cream cheese hollandaise that sold me on ordering this dish called Caprese Benedict. Now, you get the usual, you know, the homemade English muffin, the expected tomato, mozzarella, and the egg. But that cream cheese in that sauce had great tang. And by the way, the carrot cake pancakes are pretty swell, too. Now, on the flip side is Pure Victoriana. The Silver Plume Tea Room and Antique Shop. It's in the old mining town of Silver Plume, Colorado. Now, here, the food is exactly what it should be. It's the kind of food that your great-grandmother had hoped that she had made. Everything is done in-house. Now, $6 to $11 gets you lunch entrees like shepherd's pie or a heaping chicken salad sandwich on bread baked that morning. Now, this is chicken salad the way it's supposed to be made. It's absolutely delicious. The Silver Plume, by the way, has formal teas. Their pies, I would modestly say, are worth a journey. But the best part is the people who run the place. They're all retired, and they're having such a great time that you're going to want to leapfrog to your 70s so that you can join up. Now, we've got information on both places on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, big flavors from unassuming little Portugal, and creamed chipped beef on toast is redeemed by the Stearns. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by PBS, presenting the inside world of the Big Top in Circus. You can meet the people who make the magic. Circus starts Wednesday night at 9, 8 Central on PBS. Obsession taking over our lives. Could it be possible that we've missed the boat on a cuisine? Well, tell me, when was the last time you had Portuguese food? Maybe never. This little country between Spain and the Atlantic has been hopscotched over for ages. Now, I was told, for instance, that the food was nothing special. Food writer David Leite would not agree. He grew up in a Portuguese family, and like most kids of immigrants, he spent his early years wanting to be, in quotes, American. He spent the last 15 years wanting to be Portuguese. His yearning for the food of his family led to his book, The New Portuguese Table. David, it's good to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
So you grew up in a Portuguese family, eating Portuguese food, and you decided to do a book on Portuguese food.
Yes, I did.
And you finally got to Portugal. So what did you find?
Well, it was interesting. When I got there, I found that things had changed. In the book, I talk about how when my father came here in 1959 and we were sitting around the table eating octopus stew that was thick and purple, and all these different foods from the islands, the Azores, where my family is from.
Uh-huh.
When I went to the mainland and also back to the Azores, there were so many different things happening. There was an explosion of cuisine, and there was an explosion in flavors that was going on. And I was surprised and befuddled that there was all this new cuisine. And I didn't know what to make of it first.
Was this sort of, in quotes, the new, you know, nouvelle, very fancy chefy food?
No, not necessarily. Some of it was. But to me, Portuguese food was the food that was put in front of me by the women who loved me. And that was it. That's what I knew to be Portuguese food. And I think everyone has their own limited view of the cuisine of their culture based upon their family. But when I went to Portugal, there were people making dishes, even in homes, and home cooks were making dishes that were astoundingly different. And some of them were making the dishes that my family made even better, which was very shocking that anybody could cook better than my grandmother or my mother. So that was a little humbling there. And then there were some of the chefs of some of the major restaurants doing things that were astounding and mind-bending to me, still being true to Portugal and its heritage and its ingredients, but in ways that I never saw. So I had to rejigger my thinking.
You know, this may seem like a strange question, but what makes Portuguese food Portuguese? And this, just to give you the framework I'm thinking, if someone were to ask me what makes Italian food Italian, I think I would have to say it's the taste you get from slowly browning things in a big, wide, shallow sauté pan. Mm-hmm. Is there something like that that is the tell for you of what Portuguese food is?
There is. For me, it's something called massa de pimentão. And what that is, it's from the Alentejo region, which is the lower third region of Portugal, above the Algarve, which is the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's red bell peppers that have been salt cured. And after 4 or 5 days, they're taken out, they're shaken off, and they're ground into a paste. So it's salty, it's got that peppery flavor, and you rub it all over meats like pork, beef, or you toss potatoes in it, and you roast or you sauté, and it's utterly delicious. And I have a version in the book, but I kind of go one step farther because every recipe, my father makes this, mm-hmm. and every recipe that calls for this also calls for garlic and for parsley or cilantro and wine and lemon or all these different ingredients that kind of make up even more of that, what I call Portugal in a jar.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I made up my own what's called massa de pimentão forte, which means like amped up red pepper paste. And to me, that is the essence, the flavor, the taste of Portugal. Whenever I bite into something and I taste that flavor, it brings me home no matter where I'm at.
Boy, I'm thinking about sweet peppers salted, then crushed, and then browning in a pan. That has got to be outrageous.
It is utterly outrageous, and it gives such a depth of flavor to anything you cook with. I had an email from someone today who took my version and they just smeared a little bit on top of a ham and cheese omelet using some Portuguese cheese and said it was outrageously delicious.
Well, that sounds good.
And I love it.
You know, to get a bigger sense of the food, along the same lines, for you, what are the most vivid dishes, the things that again, say Portugal for you?
It's interesting. I tend to go to the classic, or I tend to go things that have a real long history. One of my favorite dishes is called carne de porco à l'antigiana, and it's pork cubes that have been tossed with the red pepper paste and marinated a bit. Then in Portugal, they deep fry them in lard.
I love it. I'm yours.
And then they serve it on top of potatoes that have been deep fried in lard. And it really is utterly delicious, but what makes it so special is that they toss in clams at the last minute, and the clams pop open, and there's that briny saltiness of the clams, and there's the potatoes and the meaty and earthiness of the potatoes, and that wonderful pork, which is Iberico pork that they have there, which sup on acorns for their last 30 or 60 days of their life. And that is one of the iconic dishes for me, and wherever I go, it's the hallmark of Portuguese cooking. So whenever I go to a new restaurant, I always look to see if it's on the menu. And if it is, I order it. And to me, that sort of measures how close they are and how tucked into Portuguese culture this particular restaurant is. And that's one of them. I love that.
David, thank you. The idea of fried on fried, you have me. Thank you, David.
All right. Thank you, Lynn.
David Leed is author of The New Portuguese Table. Now, for David's recipe for that pepper paste, by the way, this seems to be our paste slash pesto show, he calls it amped up red pepper paste. You can go to the website, splendidtable.org. Before this tricky economy, Jane and Michael Stern were hunting down bargain eating. And, you know, they're still at it. Over and over again, they prove that good American food is alive and well and affordable. Well, they report their finds in their many books and at roadfood.com, but every week they check in here. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Len.
So where have you been recently?
Maryland. We were traveling around looking for crab cakes, and in our crab cake hunt, we found one of the better breakfast places that we have ever eaten at.
May I interject here? Because to say we found isn't quite exactly right. We're talking about a place called The Breakfast Shop, and it's a storefront in a strip mall, just the kind of place we would drive right past and say, that's not interesting at all. We have to find a more colorful restaurant.
How did we find it?
We found it because we know a guy actually at our website, roadfood.com, who goes by the screen name Buffet Buster.
That's my new name.
And Buffet Buster, when he recommends a place, we know we're onto something because he has very good taste in restaurants. And we happened to mention to him that we were going to Maryland to eat crab cakes. And he said, you know, you have to go to The Breakfast Shop and have breakfast there. So only because of his recommendation, we stopped in. And boy, are we happy we did.
Is it like a coffee shop?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a storefront coffee shop in an ordinary strip mall on a main drag south of Maryland. Nothing about it screams good food at all.
Mm-hmm. But right away, you know, you're in good hands because they squeeze the orange juice while you're waiting.
Oh.
And they have the most delicious Eggs Benedict and fabulous, thin, delicious pancakes that just float off the plate. And also one of my absolute favorite thing, which is a skillet full of eggs, sausage, bacon, ham, peppers, onion, spinach, broccoli, tomatoes, and jack cheese. All
no
That's
potatoes?
One of Jane's favorite things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Potatoes.
It's got every pig meat known to man. And what's great, it's called the Backpacker. And it's enough for two very hungry people. If you happen to be a single very hungry person, right, you can get a small version in a smaller skillet called the knapsacker.
And Michael, if I'm correct, they close it like 2 o'clock, don't they? I mean,
it's breakfast, lunch only. We never had lunch there, but the breakfast is great. And as Jane said, the pancake, you know how bad pancakes can be. I mean,
just doughy and heavy.
And these are just light and fluffy and really, really taste good. And plus, one of the things I like about this place is that you can get any amount of them you want. A tall stack is 5. There's a normal stack that's 3. You can even get a single one if you just want to taste a particular kind.
I think my favorite was the buckwheat pancakes with molasses syrup.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it was just wonderful. And in a weird way, it felt healthy because it was brown. It was natural looking.
Jane, let me just explain something. Potatoes, fried potatoes are brown. Fried chicken is brown.
Oh, that's true. And pancakes, I guess, are brown.
I mean, buckwheat is healthy.
Can we talk about another color?
Can we talk about
pink and cream colored things like cream chip beef on toast made from challah bread?
Isn't that cream weird?
Cream chip beef sounds like bad army food. What is it?
Well, SOS.
SOS, it's known as in the army. And indeed, I mean, I would say 99 out of 100 versions of it probably are really awful. But this is the real stuff. I mean, they really make it. The cream gravy that it's in is like, you know, really good cream gravy. And the beef is good. It's kind of salty and briny. Mm. But what's really good is that challah bread. I mean, it's real eggy and it's thick cut and it's toasted enough so the outside is crisp, but the inside is still tender.
I have to add something, Lynn. The wait staff there were the most bubbly, adorable ladies. And I asked one where she ate on her day off because Michael and I are always looking for other tips. And she looked at us like I was out of my mind. She said, I ate here. So, you know, any waitress who goes on her day off eats at the restaurant she works at, you know it's good.
So forget the crab cakes and just go for breakfast.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you need both.
Well, that's true.
Please.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn. Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, every week you can hear them here, but you can get their latest finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Calls for one bundle of licorice whips, one electronics breadboard, and a frosted cake, you get the idea that this is not the latest from Martha Stewart. It is the latest from a new phenomenon on the food scene. Techie science types taking on cooking and approaching it in fantastical ways. Well, we've got the crossover person with us, the cook who works with the Hungry Scientists Society. Her name is Lily Binns, and she's co-author of the Hungry Scientist Handbook, Electric Birthday Cakes, Edible Origami, and Other DIY Projects for Techies, Tinkerers, and Foodies. Lily, welcome.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Well, now, you're going to have to be the interpreter for me. What is the Hungry Scientist Society about?
The Hungry Scientist Society is a group of fun-loving tinkerers who've taken their hand at playing with food, figuring out how to put it together, take it apart, and do it all in their kitchen as though they were playing in their garage or workshop.
Now, are most of these people coming from a background of science or engineering, technology? Is that the thing that separates them from the rest of the world?
I would say the enthusiasts, the hardcore techie foodies, are graduates of MIT and Caltech, but really anybody who is excited by this kind of play can join in the fun.
Can you give me some examples of the kind of things they do?
Well, you know, it can be simple, making four kinds of peach cobbler with a variable changed in each recipe. It's not necessarily explosions or gigantic creations, but when things get cooking, so to speak, some exciting creations can happen, like making something that's a normal size, like a normal gravy recipe, into a colossal creation, a 10-gallon gravy fountain, or taking an average material in your kitchen, like a used milk carton, and turning it into a megaphone, wiring it with some old parts that you've collected in your workshop, and recycling. The fundamental philosophy is taking what you already have around the house, around the kitchen, and playing with it.
Can you give us one example? I mean, I'm setting you up for this because there's something in the book. It says, "Party like it's 2099. And it's a birthday cake with LED candles. And I thought this was fascinating.
Absolutely. This is one of our favorite classic hungry scientist recipes. We decided to try our hand, and by we, I mean my co-conspirator, Patrick Buckley, who has a background in mechanical engineering. He took his mechanical background, and I took my food background, and we decided to try our hand at making a birthday cake that would blow the socks off of our younger siblings. We took string licorice, the kind that's perfectly smooth, not ridged.
Right.
So if it's smooth, it's a little tacky.
Yeah.
And stretched it a bit, wrapped it in silver foil, the kind of silver foil that you can buy at in particular Indian grocery stores, that is traditionally used for decorating Indian sweets. I believe it's called vark or varak.
Yeah.
And it's atomically thin. And wrapping the licorice in this silver, which makes it conductive. So we created a very humble kind of homespun electric circuitry, laid it across the top of a cake like tracks, so that there's a positive end and a negative end, and then placed little LED lights that, you know, have these two legs coming out on either side of them across the cake. And then stringing way off on the side of the plate, so it's not touching the edible part a battery, and it's so exciting when you place the battery, attach the edible circuitry, and the whole cake lights up.
And it's silver covered licorice, so you can eat the wiring.
Yeah. If you're feeling experimental,
I think that sounds utterly brilliant. Hey, Lily, thank you very much. You're introducing us to a whole new side of cooking.
It's my pleasure. It is my great pleasure. Thank you, Lynn.
Lily Binns is co-author with Patrick Buckley of The Hungry Scientist Handbook. Now, to get their recipe for the 2099 birthday cake, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week the question is, what's the house specialty at McDonald's in the Philippines? Now, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking your calls, 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Just Bare Chicken, all natural with no antibiotics, vegetable-fed, cage-free, traceable to the family farm we're raised. Just Bare Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbarechicken.com.
Now, we're going to be talking with you in a minute. You can join us at 800-537-5252 or get to us on Facebook. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the house specialty at McDonald's in the Philippines? The answer? The McRice Burger, an all-beef patty with special sauce and mayo stuffed between two fried sesame seed rice cakes. True to local culture, the burgers are dipped in sweet Asian sauce, the mayo has garlic, and the rice cakes have black sesame seeds. All over Asia, McDonald's does some kind of burger that has a touch of cultural sensitivity. In Malaysia, the Big Mac becomes the Double Prosperity Burger. In Hong Kong, it's transformed into the Pork Shogun Burger. Don't ask why a Japanese title in Chinese Hong Kong. In India, the beef disappears for obvious reasons, so you have the India McVeggie Burger, and the patty is potato, rice, carrots, spices, and so on. But McDonald's doesn't give up its own great tradition, even with vegetarian burgers. The burger is loaded with mayo, it's deep fried, and Indian nutritionists say that the only healthy thing about it is the lettuce leaf and the tomato slice. You know, it's good to know that there are constants in life.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
If it seems you're okay, it is time to turn to you. Join us on Facebook. Shoot us an email at splendidtable.org or get to us by phone. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have got Gordon calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. Gordon, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello, sir. What would you like to discuss?
Well, I'm sort of, my partner in crime, my other half, Tanya, sort of put me up to this.
Oh, really? Okay, okay. So what's the deal?
We're big fans, by the way.
Thank you.
What we got going on, Lynn, is we're going to be having a dinner party of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Things going to go something like this. We're going to start out at our home with some appetizers and cocktails, and then we're going to go to downtown Wilmington here, which is very sort of culturally old and old-worldy.
Oh, I know it. It's lovely. It's lovely, yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to do the haunted pub crawl down in downtown Wilmington.
Uh-huh.
After which, we're going to go back to our home and have a late meal, a late supper, followed by some sort of a seance that we're going to attempt to do. So the question is, what kind of food items do you think we could do that don't require a whole lot of preparation for the sort of appetizer portion of this and subsequently for a meal that could be prepared in advance? That you think might be sort of in tune with the spirit of what we're trying to accomplish.
Wait a minute. You're talking about, you know, in so many words, what would be a Halloween kind of menu, a spooky menu?
Yeah, spooky menu, I guess.
Okay. Oh, this could be a hoot. Now, really, this is, you say this and immediately I think of being 5 years old. And you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Well, first of all,
we're all a bunch of grown kids.
Yeah, exactly. Deviled eggs. All right. I mean, you got to have deviled eggs. I'm just thinking now. Okay. You know, I don't know if you can get them in Wilmington, but the season's coming up for lychee nuts. They're these beautiful, they're sort of in this puckery, crisp shell that's a beautiful shade of red. And they shell very easily. But a lychee nut is white, and it can look like an eyeball. And if you guys can get some, paint that's edible, because there is this kind of thing that, you know, decorators use. Mm-hmm. You could shell a whole bunch of lychee nuts, and you could keep these in the fridge, you know, and everybody would just eat them with their fingers or you'd have toothpicks. But anyway, you could paint eyeballs on them, and that could be one of your hors d'oeuvre. Or you could, you know, even do them on a little toothpick or a little skewer in a martini. You know what I mean? But they'd be like little eyeballs. Wouldn't it be wonderful to do like a baked spaghetti casserole that you could call, well, this is really being a five-year-old, but I'm just thinking you could call it Dracula guts with virgin blood sauce, you know, or something really creepy like that. Squid ink pasta could be great.
Squid ink pasta.
Yeah, now squid ink, you know, is black, and you can sometimes buy it frozen. And the idea is that you boil up pasta, you saute in olive oil some little hot chili and garlic, and you can throw in, you know, anything you want. But you toss in the squid ink and you toss the pasta, and it turns black. And it's really creepy. Do you know the dessert Floating Island?
I'm not familiar, no.
Well, this is a custard that you make this all ahead. This is a custard, a spoonable custard, very simple custard that you stir on top of the stove. You do this a day ahead. And then you make meringue, and you scoop it into ovals, and you poach it very lightly to cook it through. And then you put it on top of the custard so it looks like little floating islands. But you could make believe they're ghosts. And, you know, it could be like, you know, the haunted dessert or something on that order.
Mm-hmm.
Fire and brimstone Bloody Marys. So you take gray salt.
Bloody Marys, that's a good thought.
Yeah, Bloody Marys. And then on the rim, you could do chili powder with that gray French sea salt that could look like burnt, you know, brimstone or whatever. Or just rim the glass with chili and salt. That's mm-hmm. all. Wait a minute. How about a roast chicken where you have the wings crossed over its breast? And chicken in its final resting place is what you could call it. With monster mashed potatoes. I'm sorry. This is you've let me loose. I'm going to be at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to be nudging my husband, saying, "Hey,
exactly what we need."
I have a feeling you've now inspired much of the country to consider, you know, if they haven't already, consider a party for Halloween. Hey, thanks.
Oh, definitely.
Thanks for a really fun time.
Thank you, Lynn. I appreciate it.
You take care, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or check us out on Facebook. Okay. Amy's calling from Cincinnati. Amy, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I'm sitting in my kindergarten class with my farmers who have grown a plethora of pumpkins. They're all very small. They're about softball size.
The farmers are small or the pumpkins are small?
Well, that's exactly it. Last year, we made pumpkin soup for our big feast. This year, we've cooked the seeds, of course. We've tried the bread, and we've attempted the cake. But I thought, well, I'd ask Miss Rosetta Casper and see if she has any great ideas about what to do with small, darling pumpkins.
Is it sweet pumpkin?
I believe so. I think they're like little midget pie pumpkins.
So they're really going to be sweet?
I hope so.
Well, you know what everybody can do? And they can do this with, like, plastic knives.
Uh-huh.
Is, first of all, you might want to cut up the pumpkins for them.
Okay.
All right? And you're going to cut them into squares.
Okay.
Or rectangles, any kind of thing. Scoop out the seeds.
Okay.
Score the flesh.
Uh-huh.
You know, like a tic-tac-toe.
Uh-huh.
And you want to rub it with a bit of butter or olive oil.
Okay.
Okay. And sprinkle it with cinnamon and salt and pepper and a little brown sugar. And then you're going to roast it in the oven.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
You can put it on a baking sheet, and you can roast it at about maybe 400 degrees.
Okay.
And let it cool, and everybody can just spoon that stuff up. You roast it until it's really soft and tender.
Oh, boy. How
and you can eat it warm. I'd say 45 minutes maybe.
Okay.
Maybe an hour at most. It depends on the size of the squares. And that would be utterly delicious. And then they can scoop that up, and they can mash it. To make, like, instead of mashed potato, mashed pumpkin.
Ooh.
They can add maple syrup to it. They could add
maple syrup is a staple in our class.
That they could add, well, then maple syrup would be fabulous.
Right.
And if you want, you know, if you don't want to put the brown sugar on it, you don't have to.
Uh-huh.
But I just like the way it helps it with sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what you could do, and I think it would be fabulous.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. And
yeah.
It sounds easy, too. That's the other criteria.
Yeah,
you know?
And then, you know, once it's cooled down, they can make all kinds of things out of it.
Oh, good.
And they could even mold it in small little cups, you know, like little paper cups.
Oh, cool.
And then maybe top it with you know, some maple syrup and that kind of thing. So it looks like little hills with maple syrup coming down.
Little sculptural medium there.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I would say when you do the sugar toward the end of roasting. Let's just play it safe and make sure we don't burn it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. This is going to be delicious.
Program.
Well, thank you. And please, congratulations to the farmers.
Oh, I will. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Call us, 800-537-5252. You know, going on the cheap is a worldwide occupation. Matt Gross is the Frugal Traveler columnist and blogger for the New York Times. Now, he's been around the world and probably into parts of Asia most people have never heard of. Well, we've got Matt with us. Matt, welcome.
Thanks. I'm psyched to be here.
What strategies do you use to find food when you're traveling? Cheap food, good food. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, all food is good food. There's the first side of it, which is the before I even get anywhere side of researching, which is scouring Chowhound and asking friends and family and friends of friends,
mm-hmm.
you know, what I should eat and where I should eat. And that's usually a good part of it.
Is Chowhound your favorite? One of your favorite go-to sites?
Chowhound is really good because there's it's international now, and there's so many people, you know, everywhere from southern France to Southeast Asia,
who are
going to be able to provide you with really good insight, with on-the-ground information about what you can eat and where. You know, it takes a little bit of effort again to sort of parse out who's actually giving you good advice and who is maybe just recounting the last meal that they had. But if you use it long enough, if you make it a sort of regular, steady go-to place, then you're going to be able to get a lot out of it. And then, you know, once I get there, that's a whole different subject. That is where it gets really tough. Part of it is just keeping an eye out for any little sort of out-of-the-way corner place that looks like it might be appealing, which means that more often than not, you're actually looking for signs that you don't want to go to a particular place.
Like, for instance?
Well, I was just in Frankfurt, Germany for a wedding a little while ago, and I noticed a lot of places with plastic-bound menus out front, and I realized that that was a definite sign that I did not want to go there.
Because these were tourist places?
Yeah, they're tourist places, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Tourist places have their place.
But,
if it's the kind of menu that's going to be pawed over so often that it needs plastic protection, then maybe I don't want to get there. And, you know, when your eyes have failed you and when you can't find anything just by sort of walking around and looking, you know, you ask locals. You know, one of my favorite things to do is simply to hop in a taxi and ask to be taken where the food is good. One of my favorite places to do this, a place where I did this several days in a row as an experiment, was Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, where I speak a bit of Vietnamese from having lived there for a while. And so for about 3 or 4 days in a row, I just got in the taxi, in any taxi, and said, I want to eat the best blank in town. One day it was grilled pork chops on rice. Another day it was grilled pork with cold noodles. And, of course, I had to ask for the best pho in town. Pho is
the great soup.
The beef noodle soup. It's really the national dish of Vietnam. And it's one of my favorite things ever. And I got really lucky with that one. I had a driver who was so into this idea of the quest. And we talked on and on and on about, you know, the different practicalities involved in finding a good pho restaurant. In Vietnam, pho is often a breakfast food. And I was asking him at about 2 in the afternoon, so that made it really tricky. And he was just tickled that this foreigner was on this quest for great pho. And the place he eventually brought me to in Ho Chi Minh City's Chinatown, it was called Pho Lê, which is a pretty well-known place, but I had never been there before, and the pho was fantastic.
If you had to pick one food experience out of all this travel, you did the trip around the world. I mean, is there something that stands out? I'm not necessarily talking about a restaurant, but something that stands out.
What's amazed me is how many great meals have been essentially free. People want to give you food. They want you to enjoy the food that they've made, the food that they've bought. So I think about a great meal I had in the south of France last summer where the chef and owner of this little restaurant in a very touristy town and his restaurant was one of the absolute least touristy that there was, gave me a free meal just because I promised to send him video of the restaurant that I'd been shooting. And he just made this great, what was it, pasta with zucchini flowers and mm-hmm. zucchini in a, just a really nice light cream sauce and some clams. It was just, you know, so perfect and simple. And he was this great classic, you know, rotund, mustachioed French, southern French chef who just wanted me to eat well.
He came out of central casting. He was sent purposely. He knew you were
exactly,
with the
Times. Exactly, but his cook, no, he didn't know I was with the Times. And he loved the ingredients that he had. He carried around this big platter with the porcini mushrooms and the fish and the zucchini flowers and the clams. And he would show it off with such pride to all the diners in the restaurant. And, you know, that's the guy you want cooking for you.
You know what I remember about that kind of thing mm. was how people would share their food on trains. You know, mm. unbidden, just join us for lunch, out of the picnic yeah. basket, that kind of thing.
Oh,
too.
Absolutely. I got that taking the train from Istanbul to Bucharest last summer. It was like a 19-hour trip. And I didn't realize – this is a really stupid mistake. I didn't realize that there was no food available on the train at all. And I got there, you know, 2 minutes before the train left. So
right.
I was going to have to face, you know, almost a full day without food. But, you know, there were other people on the train and they were happy to let me share what they had. And the conductor, after some cajoling, sold me a beer. So I was pretty happy thanks to the kindness of strangers.
Hey, Matt, thank you.
No problem.
Matt Gross wrote the Frugal Traveler column and the blog for the New York Times. Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime you want. The number is 800-537-5252. Or check us out on Facebook. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Gerald Nachman, who said, when it comes to foreign food, the less authentic, the better. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, with four sections of ideas, information, advice, and destinations designed to help get more out of the weekend. The Wall Street Journal Weekend is available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.